The WLEW, News and Public Affairs Department, now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. Our guest today in the studio is Nathan Prill, Executive Director of the Huron County Farm Service Agency, just down the road from the radio station here. Thanks for being with us again. It is the wonderful time of year when we see the little things spurting out of the ground and farmers get all anxious, and you're there to help them through their good and bad.
Thanks, Craig. Yeah, it's great to be back. It is our busy season, and so we're starting to see a lot more activity in the office and gearing up for this last year of the 2014 through 2018 Farm Bill.
And again, you've got a bill, you got an idea of what you can do. Next year may not be as easy because sometimes these things get delayed or there's new programs and you got to learn them as they come. But this year it's pretty much the same as they've been doing the last couple of years.
That's correct. The major differences that we're kind of facing here for 2018 is we have some changes to our dairy program, and we are also enrolling acres in CRP again. We had been kind of on hold with that program, haven't been accepting any new offers, haven't been enrolling any new acres into CRP, into the set-aside programs. And now, finally, exactly at the time of year when it's going to be the most difficult to kind of handle it, we're going to be back signing up acres into CRP. So,
but you were telling me it's first come, first serve, you know, for eligible lands. Ergo, you know, you can't hold off on this, you know, because no one will get anything around the area if we don't step up right away and do it.
Yeah, it's been historically rare for us to accept whole field acreages. We always had specific environmental practices that we could install, and usually those were continuous. If you were interested in a filter strip or a wetland restoration or a shelter belt, we could always do those sorts of practices on an ongoing basis. But as far as doing the whole field practices, if you want to put an entire field into a grass practice or a wildflower mix, typically we haven't had that available at all times, and this is one of those times where we do, and it's 40,000 acres in the state of Michigan, and the first 40,000 eligible acres of land that we get will be the 40,000 acres that we have.
And there's advantages for the owner of the property through the program, and advantages for the wildlife and such. They get to be able to use it without fear that their young ones are going to get plowed under.
Right. So this specific program variant of CRP that we have is called State Acres for Enhancement. This specifically targets pheasant habitat restoration and monarch butterfly habitat. So there's been a lot of, a couple of years ago we were doing bees, and then a few years before that there was sort of some whitetail unlimited, some other emphasis, but right now it's pheasants and monarch butterfly habitat. So our whole field practices can either be a native grass mix or a native pollinator mix. And so the landowner or farmer would have an option to choose between those two seed mixes as far as you know, what they'd like to install. And also, anybody who had an expiring whole field contract just received a letter here in the last couple of days telling them that they might be eligible for this new program as well. So we're looking at, we're looking at about 3,000 acres that would expire this year normally. And so we're going to have a lot of re-enrollment of acres using these new seed mixes. And we're also going to have some new people, I'm sure, that are interested in the program.
Now, usually, maybe it varies on how much you sign up for, but how many years is your program in this type of program? Because I know they're not going to want you to do it 1 year and next year they're, I'm going to plow it under and I put some corn in. I mean, there's upfront costs and checking that you've done it and all these other kinds of things, and so they're looking for a long-term habitat to establish. How long?
Right. So the option on this program would be a 10 or a 15-year contract. So they have a choice of whichever they prefer.
And what happens to the property owner? Do they get something in the way of a payment for being part of the program because they aren't going to be getting any crop payment off of it? Or how does that work?
So we pay,
or is it just a tax break or something
yeah,
like that?
Actually, we pay an annual rental payment per acre. Okay. And I've been seeing those in kind of the $200 an acre range. So it's down a little bit from where it's been the last few years, but it's still pretty advantageous.
And there's not a lot of maintenance to it. There's not a lot of, you know, worrying that the guy's going to be in there plowing it up and hit a power line or something.
Right.
Because it's all, you know, once it's established, it's there.
Right. Well, with these new grass mixes, really the major ongoing maintenance component is just keeping the weeds out. So sometimes mowing or spot spraying of herbicides will be the best thing to do to take care of that. And what we're trying to do really is just get these acres installed, make sure that they're high quality, make sure that they're established correctly. And then to kind of assist in that, there's 50% cost share for all the establishment costs to get the seeding in the ground. And then there's another 40% incentive on top of that for installing those practices. So we like to say that we pay for roughly 90% of the cost to establish these acres.
But if you were planting a crop, you'd pay for the seed anyway. So.
Right. And yeah, the cost share makes it a little bit more because the seed mixes can be expensive and you know, we want to compensate.
And they're probably specialized for the climate. What we use up here would not be what you'd use necessarily in Texas or what you'd use in other parts of the country because it has to be native.
Correct.
To be beneficial to the native species.
The one thing that's kind of a challenge up here is a lot of our practices kind of emphasize flowers and grasslands. Well, the thing about Huron County is, you know, Huron County isn't really Kansas. It doesn't want to be a grass prairie.
No, those woods keep encroaching,
it,
don't they?
It wants to be a swamp. It wants to be a forest. And so one of the things that we have challenges with is these CRP acres are great. They're have huge environmental and wildlife benefits. But it's just a challenge sort of to keep them from turning back into sort of a what we call an early successional forest. So we've been going around on a lot of our contracts that some of our CRP contracts have been in active for 30 years. And we've gone to a couple and done spot checks and noticed that they look a little bit more like forest than grassland. So we've been doing some maintenance work to get those back into compliance.
Well, nature has a way of quickly reclaiming things that aren't maintained. And I'm sure the fastest growing trees sprout first, and then they're the smaller seedlings come up afterwards, and all of a sudden you're looking like you could hunt deer in there rather than housing pheasants.
Right, right. Well, and we've also changed a lot of how we've looked at like the filter strips. In the past, farmers had more choices as far as how wide they'd want the filter strips to be.
So those were mainly basically to try and keep contaminants from reaching towards the ditches and then out to the bay or to the lake. I mean, they had dual purpose in that rather than just the habitat. And you know, unfortunately, the habitat's right by this road, so the little pheasants keep running out and getting squished.
Sure.
So, but when you have a whole field, you could have more success like that.
Right. Yeah, and the whole field practices are a little bit, they're sort of, in some ways, more difficult to maintain but easier to set up in our system. Now with these filter strips, it's not just what the farmer or the landowner wants, it's what's best for the site. So in order to be eligible, our partner agency, NRCS across the hall, has to make a determination on how wide the filter strip needs to be. So you can't just walk in and say, I want a 20-foot filter strip around all of my fields. Based off your soil types, based off the depths of your ditches, you're going to get a recommendation on what actually needs to be there to provide that environmental benefit, and then you can enroll in the program or not. So we have these whole field practices, and we also have a lot of filter strips that we're trying to re-enroll, but it's a challenge because we're going to have to reset the widths on those to make sure that we're doing the getting the most bang for the federal buck as far as having these acres enrolled.
Most farmers just want it out far enough so they don't have to go around the power poles.
That's typically what we've seen a lot of with CRP enrollments on filter strips. You've got the right idea on that.
Does the land need to be somewhat virgin? Because we have a lot of land that's tiled. I mean, is it supposed to be, you know, just dirt, yeah, as opposed to a field rather than something that's, you know, with the filter strips, you could have the field tiled in the middle and it would just shoot out tubes to the ditch. But, you know, if you're going to do a whole field, and that was a big expense, I doubt anyone would take a tiled field and want, right, to go back. But, I mean, is there provisions that it needs to be pretty much basic land?
Yeah. Traditionally, our CRP acreages have been installed on sort of non-tiled farmland just because it was less desirable for farm operators to go, just less value. But we have installed a fair bit of CRP on tiled farmland, so that's less of an issue. The only time that it would be an issue would be if you were installing maybe like a wetland restoration, which is a whole field. Often times that will involve breaking field tile to kind of restore the hydrology on the site. But for most cases, tiled farmland versus non-tiled. It doesn't impact our ability. It sometimes impacts our ability to plant it in wet years, but as far as being eligible, we can enroll both.
And it doesn't need to be near a river or body of water or creek or something in order to, you know, try and make a whole little ecology out there.
Some of the practices do benefit. So one of the aspects of this whole field practice is you have to have at least 10 acres. But that can be 5 acres of cropland next to 5 acres of woods, or 6 acres of CRP next to 4 acres of grass. So the program is a lot more flexible. It's looking more at overall environmental benefits and saying we want these 10-acre blocks, we want these larger parcels of land so that we're getting the benefit that we're looking for. For in this case, again, monarch butterflies and pheasants.
Monarch butterflies need a certain milkweed or something that they have to use to eat. And pheasants, they need the cover. We're getting more and more predators back. You know, we had the DDT and that stuff and softened the eggs of the falcons and the eagles and everything else that were around here. They're making a big comeback, and they're doing it by chowing down on the small creatures in our area.
Right.
So you're trying to find a place where maybe it's more open, not trees in there, so they're not perched up there waiting for them to come out and
right.
Eat.
So yeah, the seed mixes have native grasses, and it is meant to have sort of cover, so forbs and different plant species that'll allow the little pheasants to
mature enough to be on their own.
Yeah, well, it's still a tough go for pheasants nowadays. Like you said, there are a lot of more hawks and eagles.
And on the ground, you have more raccoons, more possums, skunks these days, because when there's food supply, they will increase their numbers too.
Sure.
So, okay. And is there a deadline when they're going to close this, or is it just until they've got the 40,000 acres?
For this sign-up, we have to have everything that is eligible for this year enrolled by September the 30th. So in order for us to get our work done, we need to have all the requests in the office really probably by the first week of August. So we're kind of in a narrow time window. Normally you'd have sign up from October to September of the next year, and it's, you know, it gives us a lot of time. The window on this is a little bit narrower, and so we're looking to hopefully have those participants express their interest here pretty quickly so that we can get the paperwork done by August.
Is it helpful if they're re-enrolling land? Do you have a lot of the paperwork already? You know, you got the shape of the land, you got the size of it and all that kind of things, and you just transfer it to the new document that they're applying for?
Well, we had our training on this program on Monday. Yesterday, we have 80 contracts that are expiring that may be eligible under the new program provisions. So
what happens to people when it expires and it's not eligible? It's just your land again, and you can plow it up and do what you want with it, or
that's exactly right.
Whatever?
You get your last annual rental payment in October, and October 1st of the final year of your contract, it's free to go.
So you can start thinking about mowing it down and renting it out the next year if you can't get an extension or a new contract.
Correct, yeah. And that's what a lot of participants choose to do, depending on, you know, if a neighboring farmer is interested in renting the land, or sometimes we have cases where children or grandchildren want to start farming the land. So acres that were in CRP for 10 or 15 years, now we're seeing third generation, fourth generation farmers working up the land and planting some crops. So you get a little bit of everything every year. But on those 80 contracts that are expiring, yesterday we ran scenarios. So that would tell a participant what their new rental rate would be, because the rental rates were set 10 or 15 years ago. So we're seeing an increase. One participant yesterday went from an $85 an acre land rent to a $196 per acre land rent on a new contract.
Don't talk to my landlord.
I know, yeah. Well, and the nice thing about CRP also is that it can't compete. So if an operator has farmed your land, you cannot enroll it in CRP without that operator's signature, because the only reason it's eligible is because it has that cropping history over the last 10 years. So that cropping history is what makes it eligible for CRP. So you can't get into the program unless the operator signs off that it's okay.
So it's important to get into the office, talk about what you're thinking of, and you can determine what's eligible, what's not. Let's move forward with this if you really want this. And especially if you're one of the expiring ones, get in there early so that you have the best shot of being first come, first served.
Exactly right.
Okay. Well, that's kind of different and new. I mean, it's nice to hear that we're trying to do things for the environment, even, you know, if we're still plowing up a lot of land every year for crops, we still have the local critters in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You were talking also about the dairy program, and we wanted to get into that. Now, you said it had changed, and we were talking a little bit before the show that for a number of years they weren't really getting much out of it, but that's kind of changed.
Right. So the way that the dairy subsidy works now, it's like an insurance product. So you're basically insuring a margin, and through USDA you could buy $4 margin to $8 margin, and that was basically cost over production. The little hitch in that was we only set cost of production based off feed. So we would look at a price of corn, soybeans, and hay and come up with this idea of what it should cost to produce, you know, 100 pounds of milk. And it didn't quite result in the payments that farmers may have anticipated when the farm bill started. So traditionally, the Huron County office under the old program, which was just a straight price support, if milk's below 1759, per hundredweight, you get a payment. If it's above it, you don't. Under this new program, you know, historically we'd pay out $1 million, $1.5 million every year in dairy subsidies. Since 2014, with this farm bill, we've really not paid anything, and that just reflects the fact that the cost of corn, soybeans, and hay have gone down.
And not to the point where the production costs are going to kick this in. So the dairy industry that has been hurting all through those years continues to hurt even more.
And there were some elements of the program that kind of discouraged payments too. So we would take an average of 2 months. So you wouldn't get a payment for January and then February. It would factor January and February together. And that average sort of resulted in payments either being lower or non-existent, mostly non-existent. So for 2018, we reopened the program with some different rules. We changed the premium structure, so farmers have to pay less for the coverage that they had to historically. And also, we're only looking month on month. So if January is a bad month, you'll get a payment for January. It won't be averaged with another month. It won't be impacted by...
Wasn't there a time when it was like, you know, you only had so many months per year you could actually get a payment? That was kind of... in there, I believe, for a time.
Yeah, so the price support was good. It paid farmers if the price of milk went below around $17.
But if you did it in the first six, 8 months of the year, and it really tanked in the last half of the year,
you made a bad bet.
You were SOL.
Yeah, so the program only subsidized 2 million pounds of production, which is, you know, a fair-sized dairy, at least, you know, for what I grew up with. But really, many producers in Huron County. And Sanilac County and Tuscola County produce very much more milk than that. And so they had to choose which months they wanted for their coverage. And sometimes they chose well, and sometimes they chose poorly.
Sounds like an Indiana Jones movie, but okay.
Yeah, it does. For this new program, you get coverage for the whole year, and you buy margin protection on all of your production. And so really, with the way that it was set up, we think we've enrolled all the farmers, but the Secretary of Agriculture announced a 1 week extension. So now if there's any dairy farmer that somehow we weren't aware of and they did not sign up in the MPP program, with the new rules that are going to generate some payments, they still have another week to sign up.
Now, you talked about production, you know, numbers. Do they have to be aware that they are going to meet that production number? Will small producers or very small operations maybe not qualify?
Oh, actually, it doesn't matter. We set production based off of the highest of 2011, 12, and 13, not to make it any more complex.
A lot of programs, you know, we sometimes grit our teeth and think it's only helping the bigger ones, but this one will help any size dairy farm. Just need the numbers to be there.
Correct. And so we're seeing that at the $8 coverage level, which we kind of do the math in the office, but we're generating payments for February, March, and April. Those are available now, and hopefully we'll be paying those either later this afternoon or first thing tomorrow. And it's looking like May, June, and possibly even July will be payment months under this program. So finally, farmers will see some assistance from the federal government. And it's really, the payments that are generating are a small amount compared to what farmers have lost here in the last 6 months. So the program, we're glad that we have a program that pays. We're signing farmers up, but you just wish it was more, because the situation out there is so, so bleak, so difficult.
Is all milk involved in this? Because there are different grades of milk or something. There's, you know, there's the stuff we drink out of containers, but there's a other class of milk that generally goes to cheeses and such that has different standards and quality and such. And is all of it covered in this, or is this just primarily what we're thinking about as milk?
Right. So if there's anything more archaic than federal farm programs, we can talk in like class 3 and class 4 milk pricing structure, which is also very confusing. But yeah, we go off, and that's actually another element of the program. Like, Michigan dairy farmers have suffered more than in other states, because Michigan's milk price is a few dollars lower than the rest of the nation because of shipping costs, because of our processing capacity. And so another weakness in this program was it didn't take into account that not every state pays the same money for 100 pounds of milk. And so Michigan's really just had kind of a tough time with this dairy program.
Well, there's not a lot of grazing in Nevada.
No.
Ergo, you know, their milk production is virtually none, so they have to import. But we have a lot, so it doesn't have to go as far, and it, you know, to be shipped out or whatever. And then you have local producers and their own brands and stuff, and it's like, you know, it's self-contained.
Yeah. Well, you've got a national program that tries to address national problems, but the country is very different. But I will say the lowest paying state for milk in the nation is New Mexico, but Michigan is second lowest. So this national program that sets sort of a national price and then a national margin isn't really taking Michigan into account specifically, but we're kind of just doing the best with what we have.
But again, you have information at the office. I'm sure there's on the websites for the Farm Service Agency, there's initial information if dairy farmers want to look at it and see what's going on. And you say most of them have done it anyway. If you haven't, you say most of them in our county. We do reach into parts of Santa Lac and Tuscola County. Seek out your Farm Service Agency office. Get in there and make sure that you take advantage of what's out there, because it's tough enough as it is.
Right.
Don't bypass any help you can get. Are there a lot of strings in the program? I mean, there's like crop insurance and stuff. You have to do the reporting and all of that kind of stuff because, you know, you want to make sure that things are going well. But, I mean, is there, you know, do they have to weigh the strings against the benefit?
You've been talking to us for a few years. You kind of know that there's always sort of a hook in the worm. In this case, the hook with MPP was from 2014. If you participated that first year, you had to participate every year of the program. So you had to pay a $100 administrative fee, and you had to participate. If you started in 14, you had to pay 15, 16, 17. We have a few participants who started, did not pay their fees for 16, 17, because they didn't see value in the program. And now, in order to participate for 2018, they have to go back and we have to go back and collect those fees for the previous years because they were required to continue
but
with the program.
But you can do it retroactively.
Not retroactive. No, this would be just for 2018.
But I mean, you have to pay the old ones up to date first in order to get to pay this year's and be in part of the program.
Correct. But the nice thing is you're signing up for an insurance program that you know 6 months into the year what the payments are going to be. So there's a little bit, that was another part of this, like reopening sign up and having the deadline be in June, you could participate in a program with a clearer idea of what your payments would be for the year. So that was another benefit that was sort of extended to dairy farmers, given how bad situation is out there.
Is it a single yearly payment, monthly, or how does that work?
We're paying monthly.
Okay, because, yep. You know, you're getting into the time of year when you can send the cows out and just let them graze and only supplement their feed with a little more protein and whatever to get what you want. Whereas in the winter, you're housing and feeding them full time. The costs are different. So it's all reflected monthly cost basis, what you get and what you need.
Correct.
Okay. Well, that's better. I mean, at least you're not getting it all when the grass is green, and when it's not, you're scratching your head going, oh, dear.
Well, the interesting thing is, so here in county, because we have a few other commodities, you know, we plant some dryable beans, and I guess sugar beets are planted early, but we plant crops in June. And so nationally, having a dairy sign up in Huron County in the Thumb region is by far the largest dairy area in the state of Michigan. We're doing crop reporting. We have this Conservation Reserve Program sign up, which we think is going to, there's going to be a lot of interest out there for it. And we also have this dairy program. This has been kind of a challenging few weeks, but we're, everyone's holding together.
You're saying that so politely, and I'm sure you're back at the office pulling your hair out.
Well, the staff gets along. You buy pizza every once in a while. You make the best of it, but this is a busy time of year for us, and we're...
Make sure it's real cheese on the pizza.
Exactly. Yeah, we've got to support the dairy farmers. This sign-up is going to be, it's going to be a challenge, but, you know, farmers come in, report their crops as soon as they get them planted. Don't wait to the last day. Don't wait to July, the July 15th deadline.
Is it all the same this year? There was a time when you had to report crops at a certain point, and then there were other crops that were later because I guess they were planted later.
Yeah.
Is it all at one time, or is that still in effect?
They changed it. So historically, wheat and small grains were due at the end of June, and then we had the July deadline for corn and beans. Now we report wheat and alfalfa and mixed hay in the fall. So the only deadline we have is the July 15th deadline to report dry beans, sugar beets, corn, soybeans, spring-planted alfalfa, any spring-planted grains like oats, or there's some spring barley out there too nowadays.
So, do you get more into the specialty crops now?
We're starting to.
It used to be that, you know, it was kind of like the big three, corn, wheat, you know, sugar beets around here, maybe beans, and make it big four. But it was, you know, we're doing a whole lot of things nowadays in the area that just, you know, we've diversified very much.
Yeah, I'm really interested. A couple of farmers are doing malting barley.
For brewing.
That is something that's going on.
Hops is getting bigger in Michigan. Because the craft beers locally want locally produced stuff so they can say it's a whole Michigan product. Mm-hmm. So those are our other areas. But you have to have the land that's right. You have to have the climate that's right to make things grow, and they work better in some places than others.
Well, and even just the industry. So one of the justifications for these federal programs, it's once you lose an industry, it's really difficult to get it back. So in Huron County and in Michigan, we grew thousands of acres of malting barley. And a lot of farmers, a lot of listeners will remember when we grew a lot of malting barley up here in the Thumb. It went away. So trying to recreate that industry and get the infrastructure back in place is so difficult. So that's one of the reasons why we look at these sugar programs and dry bean trade benefits and a lot of other things that we benefit from. It's because if we lose those industries, the chance of ever getting them back is remote. So we have to protect these industries. We have to protect the sugar industry for our area. We need to protect dryable bean and trade and exports. We need to support these so we don't lose it, so it doesn't become like malting barley where the Stroh's brewery in Detroit closes and the malting industry goes away in Michigan.
But a lot of the change happens because of prices.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's the driving force in agriculture. You know, if you're going to get more for planting corn than malted barley, then you're going to go where, you know, the dollars are, because you got to keep your farm going, your family fed.
Sure.
So a lot of this, because they were specialty and didn't have a great big support group for it, didn't necessarily pan out.
Right. But that's the nice thing about being up here. We have a diversified farm base. We have beef, dairy, pork production, some poultry. We have specialty crops. Like the joke that I sort of have is, you know, in Michigan, Michigan's not a corn belt state, so it's not a lot of corn and soybeans.
This isn't like Kansas where you have wheat field after wheat field after wheat
right.
field after wheat field, and then you go to another state and it's corn in Iowa. I mean, we really do. I think we're only second to California in our diversity.
Right. That's right. And so when you're talking to other counties, they're trying to justify how much busier they are. And my argument is always, you know, here on Santa Lake and Tuscola, we're about as busy gets. And they'll talk about fruits and vegetables over on the west side of the state and vineyards and asparagus. And I say, well, we have that too. But technically, dry beans are legally considered a fruit and vegetable. And so we still have more acres in fruit and vegetable production than any county in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, well, that's like tomatoes. It's a fruit, not really a vegetable, and if people don't see it that way and they don't think of it that way, but when you're doing farm programs and such and you're doing statistics, it is what it is.
Well, it's just a challenge because in the county we have to calculate payment reductions because you can't collect payments for grain commodities on land that's planted to a fruit or a vegetable. And so since dry beans are considered fruit and vegetable, they get, if you overplant dry beans, you'll get a reduction in your farm subsidy on your payment through the government. I don't understand it either, but it's been law for a long time, and
I'm sure somewhere there was somebody, you know, messing with the system, and it became a rule. That's usually how laws happen around this country, is, you know, it isn't necessarily people in the thumb doing bad things. You know, we have things going on in the Detroit area, and all these cumbersome rules come up for government and other things, and I'm sure it's the same in the ag industry.
Yeah.
Some places, and their needs are different in different places, too. So. But if people have questions, they can contact your office.
Yep, stop by the office. The major thing is let's get the crops reported for 2018. I know some planters are still rolling. We're planting dry beans this week.
We got a late start this year, didn't we? Is that getting farmers now eager whenever they can to get out in the field and not thinking about coming in?
Well, compared to last year, just because soil moisture levels, we're in a much better place than a lot of other areas of the state of Michigan. So fortunate for us. I don't know, last year we had some pinto beans and black beans and navy beans planted in July. I never thought that. So this year feels early to me, but that's kind of compared to last year. There were certainly some delays in certain parts of the county. So I think we'll be right on target for getting things closed up here in the next couple of weeks, hopefully.
Well, terrific. Anything people need to know about? I know there's a lot of uncertainty out there with, you know, people talking about tariffs and trade wars and such, and agriculture always seems to get dragged into it. You, as a government agency, can't, you know, advise people in what they should do or what they're not, but it is a good time for farmers to think about how best to hedge their bets on what's coming.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't tell them what to do. I understand that. I'm just kind of saying it because it's because I don't want you to lose your job. I'm just saying, you know, if there's uncertainty out there, you know, think of that when you're plotting your course through the year. Do you need to be feeling a little safer or not?
So, well, the major...
And these are what the programs are for, to give you some hedging, some safety net feeling about when you're moving forward in your season.
Right. Well, so politically speaking, what we're all thinking about right now is more day-to-day politics. Well, trade certainly impacts agriculture, but from our office's standpoint, it's more about the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is kind of this wonderful standalone piece of legislation that dictates what we do. So it doesn't get caught up in all of the annual budget fighting. It doesn't get caught up in a lot of things. Our programs stay pretty consistent. So what we're really focused on now is, so this is the last year of this Farm Bill. Are we going to have a one-year extension of the Farm Bill, which we've had in the past? Are we going to get a new piece of legislation that's going to change our programs?
And every time they do it, they change something.
Yeah, well, the Farm Bill that covered 2014 to 2018 was a drastic change over what we had had for the previous 10 or 15 years. And so sort of adapting to that and having a new Farm Bill in mind, if it brings as many changes as the last one did, it will be a lot to sort of adapt to. But it seems like maybe the Farm Bill process is a bit stalled, so maybe we'll look at a one-year extension and just keep things the same for a year. One way or the other, we will find out before September the 30th, either shutdown or Farm Bill extension. There's a lot of big items on the agenda right now.
And people hear the Farm Bill, they just think of the farm programs. It encompasses a lot more in nutrition and such things, so when they're debating it, there's a lot there's going on in other areas, but the Farm Bill is the aspect you deal with. The farming part of the bill is what you deal with.
And I thank God for it every day.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking time coming in here. Any other things people need to know about this time of year?
Nope, that's it. Just schedule an appointment, 269-9549, and we'll get those crops reported.
No need to update your maps quite yet?
We're pretty well caught up on map correction, so we're in good shape. Things are looking good in that department.
Until you get a new set.
Well, we are getting new imagery here in August, so it will change everything again, because the pictures we have on our layer are from 2016, so we should have some new imagery available for farmers here in the coming weeks as well.
Well, you'll see where buildings have gone up and other things, and check to make sure this was accounted for in the program and all that stuff. It's all the double checking and I-dotting and T-crossing that you have to do behind the scenes that, again, people don't see has to happen.
Every once in a while, you'll see round bales in a set-aside field where someone's done some haying when they shouldn't have, but that's rare. Farmers and landowners in Huron County and the Thumb region do a good job of following the rules. Makes our jobs a little bit easier.
Terrific. Your number again?
269-9549.
Extension?
2.
And you get right through the office, find somebody to talk to, or they'll schedule for appointment to come on in and tell you what kind of paperwork you need to bring in so that you can get things a-rolling.
Sounds great.
Our guest today on the program has been Nathan Prill, Executive Director of the Huron County Farm Service Agency. I do want you to stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news.